The book of Nahum. If you'd like to turn to Nahum, it comes just after Micah. Now try to shift your thinking a little bit to get all this sorted out, which does take a bit of time sometimes. We're going back to the days of the Assyrians. It's not too far back, possibly, because the Assyrians were the great power over the Middle East, the Fertile Crescent in particular, for a very long time. Much longer, in fact, than the Babylonians lasted. And the Assyrians had, of course, their strong times and their weaker times, but this went on for a couple of hundred years. But particularly in the last 120, they had been the major force. And all these great empires, the Old Babylonian, the Assyrian, the New Babylonian, the Persian, and then the Medes and then the Persians and then the Greeks, they all had central points over in the area which currently is going through all sorts of upheavals, Iraq and into Iran. That was the center of these great empires that, in a sense, were seen as standing in opposition to the people of God. In the Bible, Babylon, which was held by Assyrians, it was held by Persians and so on, Babylon is the great citadel which stands over and against Jerusalem. And those two are like the two foci between the good and the evil, God's work and man's work. So the book of Nahum is going back to the Assyrian period. The Assyrians, a good while ago, had finished the northern kingdom of Israel. That was in the 8th century, 721, 722. They surrounded in 721 the city of Jerusalem, and they were threatening to finish Judah off as well. The northern kingdom had all been taken off into exile, and now the little kingdom of Judah that was left, because you remember Israel had divided into two, down there in the south, still hanging on to Judah, still hanging on to Jerusalem, still hanging on to the Davidic dynasty, to which had been promised the Messiah. This little tiny country was just about to be finished off by Assyria when something hit them. Herodotus, the historian, said it was a plague that came from rats. But the Bible says the angel of the Lord rose up, and the Assyrians got up in the morning and found they were all dead men, so they sort of thought we'd better give up and go home. And that is recorded for us in the British Museum on a piece of stone, a stele, and the stone tells us how the great king Sennacherib had conquered this and conquered this one and conquered this one. And he gets to Jerusalem and he's modest enough, which is surprising, to say, "And King Hezekiah of Judah, I shut up like a bird in a cage." Well, that's exactly what he did. But he didn't go on to say, he just leaves an inference that he won. But in actual fact, they never totally conquered Judah. But although they didn't conquer them, and the army had to withdraw, so the state still existed and was going to exist for over about 120 years yet, they still were not a totally free people. You had to keep on paying respects to the emperor of Assyria. And this was the sort of way in which the whole of that area was being governed. And every now and again, Egypt would rise up and want to take some of the land back. And then Assyria would have to hit back, and that's where the wars would come. That's how Josiah, in the end, the good king, finally was destroyed, because he, without taking the advice of the prophets, he went out against the Egyptians, and he was destroyed. And the danger always was, which political band shall we belong to? There'd be a party for the Egyptian suzerainty, and there'd be a party for the way in which the Assyrians maybe would govern and look after them. So there was always that kind of tension in this tiny little land of Judah. Well, we've reached the point where the Assyrian period is going to come to an end. They are pretty strong. They're pretty strong with the way in which they are still conquering and defeating Egypt when Egypt tries to hit back. And there's been a particular victory when they went down into Egypt and destroyed a place called Thebes. in the text, in the Hebrew text, it goes by the name of, over in verse chapter 3 and verse 8, are you better than no Ammon? That is the very large and important capital city of the Egyptians at the time. No Ammon, at least, no, it wouldn't be the capital, but it was a very, very important place in Egypt. And they destroyed that. And I mentioned that in the notes here in 663. So what is the time that we're looking at? We're before Obadiah, which we've just been, got to get our minds now orientated away from there, where the Babylonians were the dominant ones. Now it is back to Assyria. Nahum and his prophecy would be between 663, when Ashurbanipal sacked Thebes of Egypt. And that's why it's mentioned in chapter 3, verse 8. It says, are you any better than Thebes? Are you better than Noamon, who were not able in any way to hold back the might of the king? Now it's turned round and said, you remember how you destroyed, how you Assyrians destroyed Thebes? Are you any better than Thebes, because you're going to be destroyed by the Babylonians? And so Nahum and his prophecy between 663 BC, when Ashurbanipal sacked Thebes, and he refers to it here, and it's the fall of Nineveh, which was in 612. That's when Medes, Babylonians mainly, and Scythians in some texts, Medes, Babylonians, and Scythians, sieged Nineveh and sacked it. It seems in the first place it was the Medes who were primarily responsible, joining with Babylonians, but the Babylonian dynasty, and being called Babylonians anyway, took over, and that's why we begin to see the Babylonians in the first place. The Assyrian supremacy of over 100 years was replaced by Babylon, and the prophecies fulfilled. The dates, therefore, that are most likely would be somewhere before 627. Now you say, why that? Well, Ashurbanipal died in 627, and from that time onwards, the empire of Assyria got weaker and weaker. But when Nahum is prophesying, you can see that he doesn't look at Assyria as anything weak at all, or that it's gradually decaying. He can see it in its full strength. And consequently, it's probably likely that he prophesied the 612 fall of Assyria, the fall of Nineveh, which incidentally has been spelt wrongly once or twice, as you can see. It's not Nineveh, you know. It's not that sort of upmarket kind of stuff. It's Nineveh. It's E-A-H. And sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. You better ask Jeff why. I'm not quite. Was that unkind? He's such a godly fellow. I can pull his leg. Yeah. So, the man's name means consolation or comfort, Nahum. And he comes from a village called Elkosh, which doesn't really help us very much. One or two people have got some ideas, including Jerome, who was the 4th century translator into the Latin, the Vulgate. But he probably wasn't right either. I've said there it's not likely to be the village of Capernaum. Capernaum just simply means village of Nahum. But Nahum meaning comfort or consolation. Remember, even Barnabas was called son of consolation. Would have been fairly common. And, I suppose they could have honoured the prophet of Nahum. But the main thing against that is because the north had been exiled since 721. And that's a long time. That's probably nearly 100 years. A bit surprising if, although not out of the question, whether a prophet would have come from Capernaum and therefore his name been left in the village. If he did come from Capernaum and he was a kind of a leftover from the exiles, it would mean he'd have quite a lot against the Assyrians, true enough. But that may not be the best way to try and judge. We have no real clear understanding as to where this particular village of Elkosh was. Despite scholarly attempts to form acrostics, now you know what acrostics are, don't you? The Hebrews love these poems that begin with A, B, C, D, and so on. Loads of scholarly attempts, I say scholarly, sometimes you question how scholarly the scholars are, to form acrostics, or even half acrostics, to be honest, because it's only about the first 9 verses, you get the slightest hint that there might have been sentences beginning with A, B, C, D right the way through. And then they have to change one or two letters to make it fit, and then they put one or two verses round, and by the time you're finished, you say, well, what's the point of all this? Let's accept the text as it's been handed down to us, which is a far more scientific way of dealing with it, and see what we can make of what it says. And I think some of the reconstructions really are just absolutely without, totally speculative. That's what they boil down to. And then they go on and they try to rearrange verses throughout. I'm going to touch on that as we go on in this note you've got in front of you. They try to rearrange verses throughout the 3 chapters where it's considered that the verses are out of place. And the book as it comes to us is intimately woven. And I've then added, and logically proceeding nuances, perhaps there should be an S there, on the judgment of Assyria and the salvation of Judah. Consequently, the divisions are not easy to establish. However, it's helpful perhaps to divide it, and I'm going to do that, but let's just go back a line and think about that statement I made. The reason why scholars mess around with the text so much here is because they can't get the idea of kind of knitting or weaving something as opposed to just sort of setting it out and putting a line round it and slacking it down there like my notes are and so on. And they think that the ideas are overlapping. Well, of course they're overlapping because the whole of these 3 chapters, there is overlapping between judgment and salvation. The wrath of God and the love of God. The jealous good God and the God who has got to bring sin to account. Those are the weavings together. And so as soon as you've said something negative, you, like a good prophet, want to say something positive. And that weaving together is just simply good literature, good prophesying, and much more attractive and helpful ways of building people up. If you just pages, if you put all the negative pages of the Bible together and just went from one and another one, I don't suppose you'd ever get to the good part. There's some preachers like that. They start with all the bad, and by the time they get to the good bit at the end of their message, everybody's gone to sleep because they only heard the bad. Nahum is a closely woven book of judgment and salvation. And that is significant because in the final analysis, the judgment of God that comes upon Jesus on the cross, now is the judgment of this world, is intimately woven, so you can never pull them apart, with the salvation of God which is offered to all mankind. It is saying that to us. This is the way of God. Not only in a, say, prophetic medium, this is the best way to do it, or in a literary style, this is the best way to hold attention, but it's theologically correct to understand that as God works in judgment, he's also working in salvation. We have to put them into 2 compartments because they're 2 different ideas. But God, to solve the problem of the world, somehow or other has got to get those ideas together. And he does that on the cross. That is the brilliance of it all. Oh, the depths of the wisdom, the untraceable ways of God, his ways are past finding out. And that's how Paul worships the wisdom of God. So it's similar to that. However, as I say, it's helpful to divide into 3 parts. And I'll go through the titles that I put out on the notes here first. The first part of the book, I'm going to cut off at chapter 2, verse 2. Chapter 2, verse 2, where there is both judgment and salvation. Judgment on the oppressor, Nineveh and Assyria, and salvation, which is being offered to Judah. Those are the 2 parts that come to a conclusion. Even then, having said that, what has been said in that first part is then taken up at the beginning of the second division, and is expanded out. Because it is good literature. It is good prophesying. Not because it's got to be confusing and it needs the nitpicking scholars to try and divide out and pretend they know which verse came before another one. So the first part, from 1:1 to 2:2, is the psalm, it's like a psalm, concerning God's wrath and God's love. You might say at first, the psalm looks to me pretty well all entirely like God's wrath. And that's because we don't understand, for instance, the word jealousy. It's God's love and God's wrath together in this psalm, showing us something about God which is a major contribution to our grasp of understanding who he is. Not to be dismissed, as we can do without it. Then, when you move on to the next section, from chapter 2, verse 3 to verse 12, technically it's what has been called by scholars over the centuries a taunt song concerning the Battle of Nineveh. It's sort of a mocking song. It's almost like Psalm 2. The Lord will laugh them in derision because of the kings of the earth rise up, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And the Lord just dismisses it. There's nothing in it. It's just a waste of time. What do you think you're doing? It's how ridiculous. And it's like a taunt song saying, you're not going to be able to get out of this one. It's too late now, Syria. You're finished. And so that taunt song runs through to verse 12. Then in verse 13 of chapter 2, down to verse 19, there is approbation, literally applause, of God's verdict against Nineveh. God's verdict against Nineveh. Look at the last verse, verse 19, chapter 3. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you. On whom has not your evil passed continually? Where there is continual evil, at last when people are delivered, they say, this is God's verdict on Assyria. This is what God's done, and they give a cheer and a clap. That's their approval, their approbation as to what God has decided to do. When we live in ease, except we have got the television ought to inform us of some things. But when we live in ease, we can shut our minds and shut the door on all the things that are going on in the world. If you'd had your children bombed in Iraq, if you'd been in the prison camps of Saddam Hussein and been jumped on by his son who broke your back and so on, you might have cried out to God for vindication and for judgment. If you don't feel like that occasionally, I want to ask you to try and begin to feel like that. I remember the words of an old Quaker, and I can't remember who it was now, but he said, the trouble with some of us is that we cannot hate enough. What he meant was to hate evil. Jesus loved righteousness and hated evil. And there are hateful things that we are soft on, especially if they don't touch us, but other people only. That's because we are not able to empathize and enter into the hearts and lives of those that we're meant to be loving and caring for. And so there is a place when impossible to describe foul things are done by... I know myself, when I was younger I used to be able to do it more easily. I can't do it now. Some of the stuff that appears in films, you know, like the River Kwai film, whatever it was called recently, and I just... Yeah, but it's not the, it's that same story, but it's end all wars. I just find I don't want to watch it anymore. I can't stand it because it's so foul and terrible things being depicted. And you just don't want to see it. It's beyond description. You don't want to feed yourself on that sort of stuff because what's it going to do to us? And yet we know it happens. And therefore, if God doesn't come and splat it out of existence, if you don't feel like that sometimes... You are not human. You are not the kind of human being God intended you to be. You've lost your ability to be angry. And you've lost your ability to be angry with evil. And of course it's very difficult to separate evil from the person's doing it. But that is the sum total of the matter. These Hebrews looked at what was being done and they hated what was being done. And you might think, well, therefore they were hating. the people doing it? That is another question altogether. Evil is to do with personal relationships, it's to do with people, and to separate the two is virtually impossible for us. If God is able to do that, and presumably he is, otherwise there would be no salvation, then that's great, but whether we can do it or not, I don't know. So there should be times when we feel angry, as well as times in which we weep for people. And perhaps, I mean, this is just all extraneous, just simply to the text, but trying to justify, if you like, the wrath of God, which people don't like. It is describing God in terms which are right and proper, because we're made in God's image. We feel angry about these things, so does he. And he's angry about sin and the destruction it brings. I'm very angry if my children do things that utterly disappoint me as to their true humanity and their being like Jesus. And that makes me ever so angry. If the next door neighbor's kids do it, I might be a bit angry because they make a noise. If they're down the road and I can't hear them at all, it probably doesn't worry me whatsoever. So that's because I'm limited and I'm finite. But God is infinite. And God is able to express at one time and then, as far as time is concerned, and another, both his wrath and his love, both his anger and his compassion. And they belong, like they do with me and my children, to the same set of circumstances and the same things that are going on. I can be angry about them because I love those kids. I'm angry about them because I have compassion and I want to see them enjoying and being fulfilled human beings, not destroying themselves. So don't be afraid of anger. How you express it is another matter. But don't be afraid of it. Just be aware that it's a part of being a human being. And therefore it's a part of understanding God, because we're made in his image. Does that help at all? So the wrath of God is all intimately linked up with his compassion and love. So, the three things then that I've divided off are just convenient. They're not fundamental to the text, but they're convenient ways of breaking the material down so we begin to get our minds around it. One or two other little bits and pieces. In the first section, you'll notice I put the word wife, woman or wife. Judah, as we know from other passages, is the wife of Yahweh. The word wife is not actually used, but if you look carefully into the text in verse 12, speaking to Judah, God says, though I have afflicted you, that is in the feminine singular, I will afflict you, feminine singular, no longer. And that's his promise to Judah, who is in the is a female, or seen in the body of a as embodied in a female, and it's Yahweh speaking out of his jealous love to his bride, in whom he was in a covenant relationship. When we move over to chapter 2, a little bit more obscure, in chapter 2, verse 7, the little phrase in the NASB translated, it is fixed, is the Hebrew word, or is the word, I should say, huzab. And verse 7, this is a much more obscure one, verse 7 of chapter 2. And that has often had a long pedigree of translation in the sense it's fixed or it's decreed or it will be. But at the same time, other scholars have raised the question, should it be understood as a proper name, a name for a queen or a goddess? Because it does, if it's understood that way, it does look as though it's a female form. And if it is, it's something like Husab, which is maybe the goddess or the queen of the city of Nineveh at the time. And of course the description is all in a kind of female context again, just like the female context for the people of Israel, who are God's wife and are loved of him. She is stripped, she's carried away, and her handmaidens are moaning like a sound of doves beating on their breasts. So the her there could refer either straightforwardly to Nineveh, or the her maidens and so on, could refer as attendants to the actual goddess, or the queen who represented the goddess. And if it's the goddess being carried away, it makes sense, because the idols would be destroyed or carried away to the pantheon that the Babylonians would probably have of all their conquered nations. So there we've got the vision changing from the faithfulness and the love for one another of a wife and a husband here to simply a symbol which you could call a mistress. In fact, one or two translations do use the word mistress there for Hyssop, the mistress of Nineveh. And then finally, much more familiar to us because of the book of Revelation, in chapter 3, and that's in the third section again, I've got this time changing from mistress to harlot. They're written in black or in thick type, as you can see. And in verse 4, all because of many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will lift up your skirts over your face. She at one time would lift up her skirts to get her harlotry hires for her trade. Now she's to be shown in disgrace to the nations, your nakedness, and to the kingdoms, your disgrace. And then over in the towards the end, you'll see I will argue for the fact in verse 16, you have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. Sorcery, the druggery, which is being used here and by Syria, and then again in the book of Revelation by Babylon, when Babylon is enticing and seducing the nations, is the sorcery of trade and commerce. That is the seduction. That is the fix. That's the drug that captivates mankind and brings them into subjection to Nineveh. And so here she's seen as a harlot, enticing and enchanting the nations of the world. Now that's picked up and it's developed in the book of Revelation as a challenge to us in the last days. And you'll see the twin evils in a moment. We'll come back to them. Now go ahead, so you can begin to see that there's a reason for dividing in the way I've done. You've got a wife, you've got a mistress, you've got a harlot. You've got God's verdict on the Nineveh, the taunt song, and you've got a description of the city which God's wrath is against. Just one further thing to help us divide the three parts, and therefore see, three chapters, you won't be able to carry them in your mind, but three sections, if it's all one, I mean, there's three sections you can carry around. The end, within the first section, when it talks about the judgment that's going to fall, there are two verses that have got the same line in them. That's Nahum chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of its sight. That's Nineveh's sight. And will pursue his enemies into darkness. Whatever you devise against the Lord, he will make a complete end of it. The it, again, is in the feminine form, referring to Nineveh as a city, as a woman. Distress will not rise up twice. And so it goes on. So I've just simply put that double line together to remind you that it's there. And so there must be, you know, it's what's said twice, maybe looked at seriously, and called it liquidation. Because it's the only word beginning with L I could think of that goes with the next two. Liquidation. The site was overflowed with a flood. And in fact, water does come into the destruction of Nineveh, as we shall see. But then in the second section, there's another L, and I've put this in a box, lions. Look at chapter 2, verse 11. Remembering, this is taunting is Nineveh. Where's the den of lions? Where's the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion, lioness, and the lion cubs, lion's cubs, proud, with nothing to disturb them? The lion tore enough for his cubs, killed enough for his lionesses, filled his lairs with prey, his dens with torn flesh. And then again in verse 13, the sword will devour your young lions. So this lion-like attitude of the people. I suppose the British must have been charged with this many times during the time of the British Empire. We walked around as though we were the lions and the pride. I remember a friend of mine telling me, he's still alive actually, strange enough, he's quite ancient, but how in the war as a soldier, and they walked down the streets in Egypt, he was utterly ashamed of being British. They just push people off the curbs. It's no wonder they don't like us out there, I tell you. But the soldiers walked down with arrogance. Why? Well, we were the British. We one quarter of the world was under our control. Didn't you know? And we acted like lions. And the attitude of the Assyrians in that time would have been just the same. Save you've got some godly Assyrian somewhere or other who's trying to fight against such sentiments and which could feed the pride of the human being. But that attitude that we are the ones and you give way to us, you know, that sort of thing? That is that ugly effect of being in the place of power. And all these lions, young lions, lions, cubs, you can see it sometimes with people with money, can't you? Lion cubs. Lions torn enough and they kill, they can get just what they like. There they are eating up their prey, nobody disturbs them. And the attitude is something offensive to Nahum, and he's prophesying against it. Then again, they're not only lions that are going to be dealt with, they're going to find their lion likeness met by a greater lion, but in chapter 3 and verse 15, the locusts come along. So part 3, I mentioned the locusts. So I've got liquidation, lions, and locusts. You were better remember that, weren't you? Well, where are the locusts? Verse 15. Fire will consume you, sword will cut you down, it will consume you as the locust does. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust. Multiply yourself like the swarming locust. You have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. The creeping locust strips and flies away. What does that mean? Well, it could mean it strips all the vegetation like they do. A crowd of locusts drop down on a field. When they've gone, they move up as one body. They leave behind nothing. It could mean that. Or it could mean the locust stripping its skin, molting and shedding its skin and flying away. The guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. And there it's describing again the armies and the peoples of Nineveh, but they are just stripping and disappearing, and the army is disintegrating and running away. And as it runs away, the armies and the force and the power is all being lost to fighting back because they are defecting. So they're like locusts, they're like lions, and they are also to be liquidated. However, the locusts and the lions are interesting because you will see, I'm really jumping a little bit here, verse 13 of chapter 2, behold, I am against you, declares the Lord, and I will burn up your chariots of fire, sword of the young lions, etc., etc. Woe to the bloody city, full of lies and pillage, etc. Noise of the whip, noise of the rattling wheel, bounding chariots, swords flashing, spears gleaming. That's militarism and violence. The violent militarism of the Assyrians, and they were brutal. They're very cruel and very brutal in their government and their empire. The Assyrians here then, lion-like. But then, like the locusts, which is much more shifty, if you look at verse 5, behold, I am against you, is the second time in this book. Twice it says, I am against you. Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts, and this is the harlot with her sorceries, which I pointed out from verse 16. They are like the traders or the merchants. The merchant side are the locusts. The military side are like the lions. The military side are violent militarism. The locusts are the commercial exploitation. Those are the twin evils that this book declares war against and that God has declared war against. And in the book of Revelation, we see them in the harlot of Babylon who seduces the nations with her drugs, her sorcery, which is, of course, commercialism. It's money. It's consumerism, if you like. And also has to ride upon the beast who is the military power who supports her and also makes use of her. When he's finished with the woman, he throws her off her back and eats her, destroys her. But militarism and monetarism go hand in hand. That's how you have power. So that's how you control. And those twin evils, even if we don't believe in any other sin, still exist and are recognized even by the most atheistic and illogical people who, without God, there aren't any sins anyway. But nonetheless, they say, these things ought not to be. And they're always the issues, aren't they, coming up in Parliament? How the money's being used and how we get it, how the military might and enforcement's being used, and whether we arm the police or not, etc., etc. Those are the two powers that all the time we're confronted with. How do we use our power? How do we seduce with our money? So Nahum has something to say, which is still to be heard today, whether we see its Christological context or not. The only rather wonderful thing is that whereas in the Old Testament, twice God says, I am against you for your military violence, I am against you because of your commercial exploitation. Although he says those things, what does God say in the New Testament? I am for you. Romans chapter 8. If God is for us, who will be against us? If God is for us, who will be against us? Something has happened that has enabled us to turn around and see that God's for us, not against us. It's terrible if God has some against you, isn't it? In Christ, he is for us. Right, well, we're ready to go, do you think? See a little bit of the book. Let's go back to chapter 1. We've got this psalm about God and his wrath and his love, running all the way down to verse 8. And then from verse 9, having looked at God's person, we will look at God's punishment. The oracle, or the burden, or the oracle, same again, it may be rightly meant to be the same word, because the weight of what God's put on his heart is like a burden. He has to be released of his burden by preaching. The oracle of Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. God had revealed this to him. A jealous and avenging God is the Lord. Verse 7, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. In between that, three avengings or vengeance, three wraths and anger in verses 2 and 3. Verse 6, who can stand against his indignation? Who can endure the burning of his fierce anger is probably better, because there are two words for anger in that one. And his wrath is poured out like fire. The four, there may be others, but I'm not aware, the four Hebrew words for anger are in that verse. The first one, indignation. Two in the second, anger, fierce anger, you could say. And fourthly, his wrath is poured out. So, like a sandwich between the jealous and the good God, there is all this anger of God. You cannot read the Old Testament and you cannot read the New Testament without being confronted with the anger and the wrath of God. You may not like it, you may wish it was otherwise, but nonetheless it is there. And if we're going to be true to the revelation that we have of God in the scriptures, and true indeed to the revelation that we have in Jesus, who was angry at Phariseeism when they planted a man who was sick to make use of him to attack Jesus, and he was angry. And when they turned children away from him, and he was angry. And when he went into the temple, and his father's house was meant to be a house of prayer for all nations, and he turned them all out, whether he used the whip on the men or not, they probably thought he was going to, by the way he slashed it around and drove out the sheep and the goats. So he drove them out of the temple. Did he use it on the men? We have no way of telling and the traditional interpretation from Chrysostom in the 4th century onwards has been that it's both sheep and goats that he drove out, not men. That's the way he understood John chapter 2. So the violence or the wrath or the anger of God is not concealed in the revelation of Jesus. It is revealed. And therefore, to ignore it, when we come to Romans, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness of men. Or the distaste of God for Ananias and Sapphira, as they pretended to be more spiritual than they were. Have you ever done that? And they obviously evoked God's response of disgust and anger. The anger of God, the wrath of God, is fundamental to our Christian truth and indeed to the atonement. I think I mentioned before. Theologian who's just died at King's. Gunton. Gunton's book on the atonement is superb, wonderful, ever so much worth reading as he takes us into the depths of the cross. The one thing he doesn't deal with is the wrath of God. Significant, because 21st century man doesn't really know how to handle it. But then neither of all generations of human beings known how to handle the wrath of God. And neither should we, except to cry out for mercy. Now, we don't like the word jealous in verse 2. We don't mind verse 7, the Lord is good. We can just about handle that one. But in this great picture of God's indignation, anger and wrath, we've got he is jealous. That is a good word. It is not the way we use jealous always in a bad sense. Generally in the Bible it's used in a good sense. It means exclusive commitment. And an exclusive commitment that therefore precludes any other claim upon the allegiance of where he has placed his love. It's similar, of course, and should be, the exclusive jealousy and commitment of a man to his wife. And vice versa. It's that jealousy that belongs to a relationship, a covenant relationship, a committed relationship, whereby you have said, I will love this man, I will love this woman to the end of their days. I will be their help and their comfort and their strength, and will be the one who, in a sense, has primarily the right and also the responsibility to serve and care and love to the dying day. That is a definition, you might say, of love in the end. And it is that jealous commitment that God has in the salvation of his people. Our God is a jealous God because when the enemy tries to seduce those rights, as it were, from God and get us to be deceived, God is angry. And God's wrath is demonstrated, as I've just been trying to explain, because he loves so much. We don't get so angry because we do not love enough. When, we say, oh, they're so civilized and grown up and adult, they just shook hands and walked out and one took the house and the other took the bankroll or whatever it was. Yeah? That is not adult at all. That is not grown up. It's just a demonstration. They have not the slightest clue whatsoever as to what love is all about. It's some pathetic kind of arrangement whereby we're put up with each other. Rather than a burning desire to be exclusively for this man or for this woman, because I can't be for everyone in this world. I'm not big enough. I'm only finite. I'm a small guy. I've got it, but I can be a little bit godlike in my commitment in this relationship. And therefore, it is one that I should get angry about if it's broken or destroyed. And a man whose wife walks out of him or vice versa, who is not angry, there is something wrong with him. He's never really loved. Make sense? God is a jealous God. And if the devil tries to take God's position in our lives by seducing us with sin and with obedience to him and his ways, God is angry. He's angry, of course, with the devil, but he's also angry with us for listening to him. And it's very difficult to divide between the two, isn't it? If it was a matter of, you know, the other woman or the another man or whatever it is in the marriage relationship, in the love relationship, which is what it is, if it's somebody else who's been, therefore, alienating the affections of the husband or the wife, then, quite rightly, it has happened all for centuries. The person offended in that way goes around and shoots him or whatever, and then gets hung himself, so it's all, you know, all gets sorted out in the end somewhere. But that is simply the way that God has made us to understand what love is about. I can't love like God can love because he's infinite. I can love, though, and demonstrate the sort of love he has towards me as an individual in the way that I love somebody back. And that is the challenge. I think in the next time I do a marriage, let's put one or two of you off. I think I'd like to preach on the wrath of God. That would do something, wouldn't it? Have a happy wedding day. That is what we've got in verses 2 through to 8. Let's somebody has called the book of Nahum the cry of an outraged conscience. That's the theme of it. And that justice must in the end prevail. But our God is a jealous God because he's a loving God and he's a good God. That's there in these verses as well as the anger. So let's have a look at this description of God. A jealous and avenging God is the Lord. He will do something about it. Some of us say we love and we do nothing about it. The Lord is an avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries. And he reserves wrath for his enemies. It's a controlled wrath. He reserves it. He channels it. The Lord is slow to anger. He even can hold it back. And great in power. The Lord will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. You say, wasn't that awful? That is terrific. God is not going to let them get away with it, men and women. God is not going to let people like Hitler get away with it. God is not going to let Saddam Hussein get away with it. We probably will. We'll probably give him 2 or 3 years in jail and he'll be a private man again. I don't know. I'm just being silly, but that's the way we treat evil. We don't think it's very serious at all. You can go out and do it again. And other people will be in pain and carrying the burden. But God is going to do that. Now, those two words in verse 3, you will find in what one might almost say is a description of the covenant-keeping God of Exodus. When God took Israel out of Egypt, you will see those very same words used in Exodus and chapter 34. Some of you, I'm sure, will be remembering it. And verse 6. Then the Lord passed in front of Moses and proclaimed. This is when he asked to see the glory of the Lord. The Lord God, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness to thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children and grandchildren of the third and fourth generation. However, we understand some of the phrases of that covenant statement. That is the God who joined hands with Israel and by the hand led them forth, not just down the aisle, but out of Egypt and began a relationship of love with his people. And those same terms, truncated of course, are used here in verse 3. Why is Nahum able to feel so outraged and put out God's outrageousness through his prophecy? It is because he understands the kind of God who is the God of Israel. He understands Yahweh. He doesn't necessarily understand the cruelty or the irrationality of the gods of the people around him. But he understands this reasonable God who is not going to let sin triumph. He will not by any means clear leave unpunished the guilty. Save he forgives, he has a way of forgiving, but he's a God of justice, and one day the universe will have to be brought into order by his justice. In whirlwind and storm is his way. The clouds are like the dust beneath his feet. And so just as the army is going to come in and destroy Nineveh, and as they march along the dusty roads coming up to the city, the dust is rising and the army is moving forward. So this is God's coming. God's going to come in the dust and in the clouds. He's moving along, and he's got his anger is directed and it's controlled, and he knows what he's doing with it. The mountains, verse 4, he rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He's already sent the clouds up into the air. Now he's dealing with the water. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. Now he's dealing with the earth. The blossoms of Lebanon wither. Mountains quake because of him. The very foundations of the earth are shaking. The hills dissolve. Indeed, the earth is upheaved in his presence. Perhaps the word dissolve there is to do with burning. As they fire their way along with a with a policy of destruction. The world and all the inhabitants in it. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the burning of his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. But the air, the water, the earth and the fire, all the elements as the ancients understood them, being affected by the movement of God as the army of destruction is moving in on the city of Nineveh. And the rocks are broken up by him. Why? Because the Lord is good. And he's a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of its sight. He'll completely destroy Nineveh and will pursue his enemies into darkness. Now, of course, it's the army that is doing this that's coming from the Babylonians. But Nahum is saying, see behind the armies and understand the movements of God. He is, just like he later was going to call Nebuchadnezzar, his servant. So God is using these forces, ultimately, to bring about his purpose in the earth. Verse 9 then moves from the person of the Lord and looks a bit more at the punishment that's coming. Whatever you devise against the Lord, he will make a complete end of it. Well, I just said that in the previous bit, he might have said. Like a distress will not rise up twice. In other words, one blow's enough. You don't have, didn't quite get him that time, was another go. Distress won't come up twice. It'll be bad enough, once will be enough. That's what's behind that phrase. Like tangled thorns, and like those who are drunken with their drink, they are consumed, and stubble completely withered. That is, it's so fully dry, it just shoots up in flames. From you has gone forth one who plotted evil against the Lord. A wicked counselor, say a lot of our texts. A Belial. That is a word, of course, later that was more often or not lined up with Satan. And so there's something that you have to choose here. Is it just a man I'm dealing with, or is there something satanic in this son of Belial, a Belial as sometimes it's called, a Belial counselor? Thus says the Lord, though they are full of strength and likewise many, even so they will be cut off and pass away. Though I have afflicted you, that's Judah, I will afflict you no longer. So now I will break his, that is the wicked counselor, that may have been Sennacherib himself, the wicked counselor, but some powerful man who did lots of evil, or it may be those who followed on after him, Rabshakeh or somebody like that, all that sounds like a title. Though I've afflicted you, I will afflict you no longer. So now I will break his yoke bar from upon you. And I will tear off your shackles. Three times the feminine singular is used. It's referring to Judah, who was under the bondage of Assyria, the Assyrian wicked or satanic counselor, if you like, who is in control. I'm going to break his yoke and will tear off the shackles. Before we leave that section, there are some interesting verbal allusions to the coming of Jesus. First, second coming, perhaps rolling them together. But verse 8, for instance, an overflowing flood. You get that twice in Daniel, that the judgment coming upon the city is like an overflowing flood. In verse 9, whatever you devise against the Lord, Psalm 2, the kings of the earth rise up, the rulers take counsel, they devise together. They are taking counsel together. And then again in verse 10, like tangled thorns. So in Matthew, the thorns come up, and the thorns and the tares are separated and burnt up, says these thorns are burnt at the coming of our Lord. And then in chapter, and then when it mentions this wicked counselor, it's so similar to 2 Thessalonians 2, isn't it? About the man of perdition who sits in the place of God and acts and talks as though he is, and everything else that might point towards God he destroys and puts down. This evil counselor, the embodiment of rebellion against God. We generally in the New Testament go on to call him the Antichrist or the Beast, as we've met him in the book of Revelation. So there is this heading up of evil into this one man. And if it was the emperor of Assyria, then it would have been, if this was written before he died, if prophesying for it, it would have been seen as somebody like Sennacherib or the emperor there. I'm going to break off his yoke and I'm going to tear off his shackles. If you've been under somebody's yoke and if you've been wearing shackles, you will know how pleased you will be at this moment that there is somebody who is standing with you. That the God who is for you is the God who is against the yoke and that shackle. So verse 12 and 13 is addressed exclusively to Judah. Probably not to the northern kingdom, but that'll come up in a minute. The Lord has issued a command concerning you. Your name will no longer be perpetuated. It seems now that he is addressing, not Judah, but back to that wicked counselor, that his dynasty is going to come to an end. Your name will no longer be perpetuated. I will cut off the idol and the image from the house of your gods. I will prepare your grave, for you are contemptible. Literally, you are light, or you are small. Light and small. You're discounted. There's nothing in you. You're like the chaff which the wind drives away. We do, sadly, talk about light people, empty people, vain people, nothing in them. And we also will say there are weighty people whose opinions you want to hear and you trust. There are weighty people who carry something with them. And that carrying, of course, ultimately comes from Christ who lives in us, that we carry life and experience and history with God with us. Weighty people and light people, I will prepare your grave. You're contemptible. You're just to be dismissed. There's nothing in you. And the gods that we're referring to there, the idol and the image, the house of your gods. Asher had Nabu and Marduk and Bel and Ishtar. Ishtar, which we get the word Easter, taking it into English language. Behold, on the mountains, and this is the most obvious quote that we get in the New Testament. Behold, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace. Celebrate your feast, O Judah. Pay your vows, and never again will the wicked one, that's the same thing again, Belial, the wicked one, the satanic one, pass through you. He is cut off completely. So you see we're swinging backwards and forwards as though we're knitting together between the judgment on Assyria and the salvation upon Judah. God's anger against Assyria, God's compassion upon those who've been afflicted. And then we go to chapter 2, verse 1, and we're back to the judgment on Assyria. The one who scatters has come up against you. And then again in verse 2, we go back to Judah. The Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob. And it's very easily discernible. There's nothing about these guys getting their verses mixed up. It's just simply a method of going from one to the other, from black to white to right to wrong or whatever, and we are seeing the whole picture that God's action is to release the Jews and it's to judge the sin of the Assyrians. Verse 15 is a quotation, of course, from the book of Isaiah, isn't it? Behold on the mountains the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace. So the good news is to do with peace. Celebrate your feasts, O Judah. Pay your vows, and so on. Now the interesting thing is, it goes on in Isaiah chapter 52 to say that the good news, which is bringing peace, is the God, that your God reigns. Remember? Don't need to remind you to look back. Your God reigns. That's the good news. And of course that is where we're going to get to at the end of the book, when it says the Lord is, well, the word reign isn't used, but it demonstrates that he's worked out and is bringing in his kingdom. So we've got this lovely verse which is summing up from Isaiah what is called the evangel. Now that's in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The good news there is the word euangelion. It's the gospel. So the gospel, the good news is, Judah's going to be set free. But the good news is, Judah's going to be set free because Nineveh has been judged. And it's the same today. The good news is not, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. You say, saved from what? The good news is that the devil has been defeated. Sin has been brought to account. And that is the good news. It's both things. It is both the love, the jealousy, and the wrath of God. It is both the anger and the goodness of God. It is both the salvation and the judgment of God, all as it were in one. Behold on the mountains the feet of him who brings evangel, gospel, who announces peace, peace towards people at last. Celebrate your feasts, O Judah, pay your vows, for never again will the satanic, the antichrist one pass through you. He's cut off completely. That is good news. The one who scatters, that's the antichrist, the wicked one I'm judging, has come up against you. This is the army of God, sorry. The one who scatters has come up against you. Man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. He's really just making a bit of, deriding them. Go on, try and get some defense against this. For the Lord's going to restore the splendor of Jacob, like the splendor of Israel. Is that a hint that one day the total people of God, Jacob, Israel, that perhaps seen in New Testament terms, including also all the Gentiles, even though devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches. In the Old Testament, Israel is often referred to as the vine, and the vine of God. But always it's in a negative sense, in that it produces bad grapes, or the walls of the vineyard have been pulled down, and so forth. Here is just again saying the negatives, the vine branches were destroyed. When we get to the New Testament, it's beautiful, isn't it? The Lord says, I am the true vine. These have all been less than true. This is the true vine, and our living in him is bringing forth fruit. You are the branches. Now we move into what I've called the second part, but it does flow on. Verses 3, right the way through to verse 10, it's all a song, this taunt song, describing the judgment as it moves up to destroy Nineveh. The shields of his mighty men are coloured red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are enveloped with flashing steel when he's prepared to march. And the cypress spears, that's the cypress, means the trees that are standing out like the spears, are brandished. The chariots race madly in the streets. They rush wildly in the squares. Their appearance is like torches. They dash to and fro like lightning flashes. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their march. They hurry to her wall. The mantlet is set up. It's describing how the leader of the troops is dependent upon his nobles. He remembers them. But although they stumble, they are staggering, and they carry a mantlet, which is the cover, which when you scup the wall of a city and they throw things down on you, that would keep off the arrows and the stones from destroying you. The gates of the rivers are open. It's almost though he's describing it happening. And the palace is dissolved. The sluice gates were almost certainly captured. And then the water was let out with a great rush, and it was a part of the way in which after that they took the city, they released water. The gates of the river open, the palace is dissolved, washed away. And then how we understand verse 7, either the goddess is taken out or it was decreed that she, perhaps Nineveh, is stripped and carried away. And the handmaidens, perhaps they'd have to be interpreted then as the inhabitants of Nineveh. Or maybe they are much more this religious entourage, and they are moaning like the sound of doves because their goddess is being removed, and they are beating their breasts. It's as though the description is going on for the sack of Nineveh. Though Nineveh is like a pool of water throughout her days, now they are fleeing. That might refer to the way that Nineveh was surrounded by the river, and the river was used to give it a defense. Or it could be that it's like a pool of water and you just can't stop it running out, and the people are running out of the city, which is more likely. It's fascinated in Norway to have pointed out to me these dams they now build that don't have any concrete in them, no cement. Have you seen those or heard of those? Just stones upon stones upon stones. And they act as a sufficient to hold back the water. Well, here it's saying a pool of water will always be fleeing out somewhere, be draining out somewhere. So it's the reverse. They're fleeing out between the cracks and the people are disappearing. Well, then there's nothing left in Nineveh. The pool of water is running dry as the people are fleeing out. The people on the gates, the captains and the leaders, saying, stop, stop, but no one turns back. They want to get out quickly. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. They're running past, they see a shop that's been smashed. They take what they can because they think it's going to serve them good, say, when they're running away from the city. For there is no limit to their treasure, wealth of every kind of desirable object. But when the troops come in, she's emptied. Yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting, knees are knocking, anguish is in the whole body. Then we get this lion-like part. All their faces are grown pale. Where is the den of lions, all these lion-like leaders and men? Where is the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion and the lioness and the lion cubs? With nothing to disturb them. The lion tore enough for his cubs, killed enough for his lionesses. Where they run away to now? Filled his lairs with their prey and his dens with their torn flesh. Moving on to what I've called the third section. Behold, I'm against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will burn up her chariots in smoke, and a sword will devour your young lions. God is against them, and the lion likeness has disappeared. I will cut off your prey from the land, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. They no longer be able to send out messages to gather people together and to collect taxes and so forth. It's all gone. Chapter 3, perhaps really starting in verse 13, where you get these two beholds, verse 13 and verse 5. I'm against you, behold, I'm against you. Goes on to, this is a sort of almost a song about the war. And it's the evil has violated others, now it's being violated. It's this kind of eye for eye, tooth for tooth emphasis again. Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and plunder, pillage. Her prey never departs. It always taking money and taking people and pillaging. The noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling wheel. Well, that's what they used to do. But now comes an alternative army. Galloping horses, abounding chariots. Horsemen charging. We used to charge and strip cities. Now you're being stripped. Swords flashing, spears gleaming. Many slain, a mass of corpses. You've sowed violence, now violence is being reaped. countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies. There are so many of them. The horrors of war are being depicted, all because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. As I said, you can get in Ezekiel a kind of a hint at this, same sort of thing, that the harlotry obviously depicts a wrong relationship, and not a relationship with God, but if you like, spiritual fornication going on. And spiritual fornication or prostitution is understood in terms that it is in a sense a money transaction. It's to do with trade, it's to do with money, and that's the God that they worship. You have to pay this God if you're going to get any joy out of her, you know, the goddess. You have to pay for it, and that's why the harlot is used in this kind of picture. And it's the merchandise which these people have traded in, and which again is the main emphasis as these verses are used in the book of Revelation. I will lift up your skirts over you, declares the Lord. I am against you, and show to the nations your nakedness, and to the kingdoms your disgrace. I will throw filth on you and make you vile. I'll set you up as a spectacle. It will come about that all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. Who will grieve for her? Where will I seek comforters for you? Well, of course, no one is sorry except the people who obviously were trading on her. Now, a kind of a side challenge. Are you better than Thebes, which was situated by the waters of the Nile, with water surrounding her, whose rampant was the sea, whose walls consisted of the sea? Literally, it doesn't actually go down to the sea area, but it was probably talking about the sea in terms of a desert sea or something like that, that was her protection. Or just in a metaphorical term, that of course a place surrounded by sea is harder to invade. Ethiopia was her might. Egypt too, without limits. Put and Lubim were among her helpers. So all the power of Ethiopia, the power of Egypt, the power of Put, and the power of Lubim, the nations round about Egypt, all came to be her helpers. Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Also her small children were dashed to pieces. They cast lots for her honourable men. All her great men were bound with fetters. So utter disgrace and degradation, and generally they would then be executed. You too will become drunk. You will be hidden. You too will search for a refuge from your enemy as you run away. All your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit, and when they are shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. In other words, fortifications are nothing. They're so weak that it's like getting hold of a tree with ripe figs, giving it a shake. Don't even have to pick them up. Just open your mouth and the figs drop into your mouth. That's how much resistance against the enemy they would have. Behold, your people are women in your midst, usually used for those who are weaker and have no courage. But there are many women who, of course, are the test of that rule. And like the woman who threw a stone and hit Abimelech on the head. But that's the normal way in which symbolism is used. The gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies. Fire consumes your gate bars. Draw for yourself water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. It's all mockery, of course. It won't do you any good. Go into the clay and tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. In other words, your bits and pieces you've got to make stronger. Get the wall stronger. Bits that have fallen down. There fire will consume you, and the sword will cut you down. It will consume you as the locust does. Well, try to be locust then. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust, the swarming locust. You increase the traders more than the stars of heaven. The creeping locust strips and flies away. Your guardsmen are like swarming locusts. Both the merchants and the guards on the doors of the city, they're all creeping off when nobody's looking. They think and they hope. And they're forsaking the city. They're just getting out as fast as they can. And they creep out, they swarm out, they're trying to move away. The marshals, it's a word that sometimes is used for people who were used to conscript the people, to get them into the army. The marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers. settling in the stone walls on the cold day. They're running away as well. They're supposed to be gathering an army. They're supposed to be putting strength into the defenders, but they're creeping away too. The sun rises and they flee, and the place where they are is not known. So they try to defect totally and will not be brought into a court-martial, because who's going to do it? They're just escaping soldiers. It's always what happens, isn't it, in war, this kind of thing. And it is just a very, very powerful description of the appalling suffering and the appalling conditions that exist in warfare. The Assyrians, who made war on everybody, are now finding war made against them, and they are failing. Verse 18. Your shepherds are sleeping. Now the shepherds are obviously the leaders of the flock, the people who should be helping them to stand against the opponent, but they're not. Your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles, the nobles should have been the chief captains and the generals who are getting the people to do something. No, they're lying down. Shepherds sleeping, nobles lying down. So what happens to the people that they're supposed to be leading? Though your people are scattered on the mountains. That's exactly the same sort of description that is given for the people of God who've got no shepherds. As sheep without a shepherd. The Lord saw the people like that, and they were scattered on the mountains, as Moses describes the situation. And there's no one to regather them. Nobody's gathering the people together. It's all at last totally come to an end. It is finished. There is no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you, for in whom has not your evil passed continually? You might not think it's a particularly nice thought. You may know that every evil person can repent and receive the good news of Jesus. You may want everybody to be saved. But if we're honest with ourselves, there are times when these sort of situations arise, nations collapse, it's the end of a war, great evil has been done, human rights have been totally ignored, folk have suffered abominable conditions, the people want to clap, it's all over. That is the victory clap, it's the applause, and God has done it. And he's brought them to justice at last. When we get to the book of Revelation and the description of Babylon being destroyed is given, it's almost, you could say, the wedding march. It's like a wedding march. And the only time in the New Testament where hallelujah is used, and it's used four times, for the whore has been thrown down, the harlot's been thrown down, Babylon has been finished, and everybody is getting clapping and cheering. Well, they didn't say clap there, but they say it here. And they're giving applause to God, who has finished with the harlot and brought in the bride. This book of Nahum is a kind of a preparation to understanding more fully what is developed and more explicitly spelled out when you get to the book of Revelation. But it's enough to prepare us that at least from time to time in history, God's stepping in with judgment. But there is an inevitability. Sow violence, you'll reap violence. Do good and show mercy and you'll receive mercy and good will come to you. There is that principle at work in society, and God is using that and will finally bring it to a total and perfect end. Alright? Book of Nahum? Good? Like it?